Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for March 27, 2003. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics, and of course, inevitably so, tonight's focus will be on imperial war, and we'll be joined in about 10-15 minutes by the some contributors to a collection called Implicating Empire, Globalization, and Resistance in the 21st Century World Order, or World Disorder. The editors Stanley Aronowitz and Heather Gautney. And in the studio we have Heather Gautney along with Ellen Willis and Pete Bratzis, and we'll be joined on the phone by Michael Hart, who all have pieces in this volume. Before we get to that, I will like to make some observations about the war. First, starting narrowly, war in the economy. The standard view embraced by Wall Street and Alan Greenspan, at least Greenspan in public, is that war anxieties have been holding back the economy, holding back spending by consumers, and holding back investment and hiring by businesses, and promoting a general aversion to risk. And, of course, capitalism supposedly thrives on risk, although sometimes the speed with which failures run to the government for bailouts makes us wonder about the definition of risk. Now, there's something to this analysis of the war holding back the economy, no doubt, and certainly high oil prices, also war-related, have slowed down the U.S. economy substantially. But this isn't really a full explanation. The war explanation plays down, conveniently, underlying problems like the post-bubble anxiety, post-bubble hangover, financial, psychological damage from the bursting of that bubble, the overinvestment hangover from the fat years, the late 1990s, fiscal problems at the state and local level, which is leading to job losses and service cutbacks, and broad weaknesses in the private sector job market. Consumer confidence numbers are way, way down, down at recession levels. In part, that reflects anxiety about war and terrorism, and certainly Americans have been telling pollsters that they're afraid that the war will increase the risk of terrorism. But they're also worried about layoffs and fading income growth. We saw some real wage gains in the late 1990s into the early part of the recession years, but now that's fading, and we're now real income growth is flattening out. Now, I thought for quite a long while that the U.S. economy has entered a time of longer-term troubles, that the boom times of the 1980s and 1990s are a memory and not likely return anytime soon. You could argue, in fact, that the rush to war was either a conscious or unconscious flight from this sad reality. We'll see when or if the war ends. Cheney promises a 50-year war against scores of countries, so it's hard to tell when the war will end. But I think the U.S. economy has some serious problems, and once Bush's war halo fades, insofar he's got a halo at all, he's going to have some serious political problems on his hands. There are also some longer-term economic problems to think about. Fiscal ruin is one. Deep tax cuts, which the Congress is working on now, on top of deep tax cuts passed a year or two ago, resulting in trillions of dollars of deficits over the next several decade or two. Deficits don't really matter in the short term, and they certainly can be a good economic stimulus against the depressed economy. But over the longer term, big deficits of this sort are just simply unsustainable. The debt rises uncontrollably. Interest payments eat up an ever bigger portion of government spending. And eventually, the creditors start calling the shots and demanding austerity programs. It's probably Bush's intentions to starve the government of revenue in order to force cutbacks in civilian spending. That was certainly the Reagan strategy, and it worked for a while. And they're probably looking for a repeat of that, assuming, of course, that they are thinking of that things in that longer term, and they're not really driven by anything, assuming that they're not driven by anything more craven than the desire to give rich people big tax cuts. But the U.S. government looks out to be on track for a fiscal crisis sometime in the next several years, even if the latest rounds of tax cuts is pared back as they were by the Senate yesterday. Related to this is another longer-term problem, U.S. dependence on foreign capital inflows. We have repeatedly imported more than we've exported, and that resulting difference must be financed with money raised from abroad. Some of it's borrowing, some of it's inflow of people buying stocks and bonds or buying corporations. But buying U.S. corporations. But in any case, that money has to keep coming in. And the U.S., as a result, internationally is seeking ever deeper into debt. The total debt burden, net debt burden of the U.S. now is about 25% of GDP. As recently as 10 years ago, it was pretty microscopic. Now, this sort of thing can't last forever either. At some point, foreign investors will say enough and start pulling back. We don't need a full reversal, a full liquidation of their assets here, just a less of a willingness to buy U.S. assets. And even a minor pullback would cause us some problems. If the United States were an ordinary country, those sorts of problems would be a deep recession, a severe kind of structural adjustment the IMF called in to prescribe, belt tightening for everyone. But, of course, the United States is not an ordinary country. The IMF is not about to come in here and impose a structural adjustment program. But it's certainly not helpful that politically the Bush administration has been alienating almost the entire rest of the world. At the same time, we need their money. It's doubtful that Poland and Bulgaria could make up for West European and Asian investors shunning U.S. assets. How the adjustment will happen is anyone's guess, but it will happen. It's very hard to run a unilateral foreign policy on borrowed money indefinitely. Some more political issues. Polls report high levels of support for Bush, but they're not that high. They're 10 to 20 points below his father's numbers during the first Gulf War, and there's much, much more partisan division than there was 12 years ago. Rita Shera, the polling analyst who's been on this show several times, argues that Bush could lose whatever happens. If the war is over quickly, people then focus again on the lousy economy. Or if the war drags on, people will turn against him. Also, elite opinion has been discreetly silent lately. But I think this is really just a patriotic impulse, and I think there are some really longer-term concerns about the way Bush is running global politics and also the domestic U.S. economy. There will be worries about fiscal ruin and going it alone surfacing at some time in the near future, I think. Speaking of going it alone, the Project for New American Century, the PNAC, I guess we can call them, most of whom are now in the Bush administration, wrote some papers during the late 1990s arguing that the move against Iraq was the first step in remaking the map of the Middle East, but also that their major strategic goal for the United States was to prevent the emergence of any rival superpower. The Iraq War is not going very well so far, and Iran and North Korea, who are also on their list of target countries, would be much tougher opponents than Iraq, a country ravaged by two wars, first the Gulf War of the early 90s, and then the long 1980s war it had with Iran, and ravaged as well by a decade of sanctions. Paradoxically, though, this kind of foreign policy may actually be encouraging the emergence of rivals. Russia's behavior is especially fascinating lately. Russia has enjoyed an economic recovery over the last couple of years. Strong leadership by the Putin gang has stabilized the country politically. It really looks like a country that has more than come back from the brink of death. It is now no pushover. Russian intelligence agencies are actually leaking info of war troubles. Iraq war troubles being reported on a couple of websites, one of them iraqwar.ru, worth checking out, though it's very hard to get into it, either because of heavy demand or because it's being jammed by our friends in Langley. But also we've got Russian companies operating in Baghdad, allegedly helping out the Iraqi defense efforts, and great diplomatic hostility coming from the Russian government. China is also, while quiet, is also no doubt watching U.S. Behavior with some alarm. During the Cold War, Russia tried to divide Western Europe from the United States, and the U.S. nightmare, correspondingly, was a Western European Soviet alliance. Well, it may be that they're getting that going right now. It could be a very bumpy road to that alliance developing, of course, but it is a very interesting long-term trend to watch, and we'll certainly be watching it here. Also, it looks like, you know, right now it looks like the U.S., or until very recently, it looked like the U.S. was at the peak of its imperial power. But, you know, maybe this is the peak of a political bubble. We saw the NASDAQ bubble burst, the new economy bubble burst, our own consumer spending bubble, maybe the next bubble to burst. But what about the U.S. as an unchallenged hyperpower, a country sucking in borrowed money at enormous rates and alienating almost everyone on Earth? Is that a rising power, or is that one that's passing its peak? Violence can often be a sign of a threatened power, not its normal exercise. So these are some of the issues we'll also be looking at in the coming weeks and months of this program. And we'll be back in a moment with the some of the contributors to Implicating Empire after this word from, well, I'll say who it is afterwards. It's kind of a surprise.
So latte, I get a double shot. It goes into my body, and you know I'm satisfied. I drive my Mini Cooper, and I'm feeling super duper. You, they tell me I'm a trooper, and you know I'm satisfied. I do yoga and Pilates, and the room is full of hotties. So I'm checking out the bodies, and you know I'm satisfied. I'm digging on the isotope, just metaphysics is dope, and if all this can give me hope, you know I'm satisfied. I got a lawyer and a manager, an agent and a chef, three nannies, an assistant, and a driver and a jet, a trainer and a butler and a bodyguard of five, a gardener and a stylist. Do you think I'm satisfied? I'd like to express my extreme point of view. I'm not a Christian and I'm not a Jew. I'm just living out the American dream, and I just realized that nothing is what it seems.
That was Madonna, of all people, from her the title song from her new album, American Life. And it seems to be some kind of critique of the American way of life, although it's always hard to tell with pop songs. But also on that album will be a anti-war song, which is due out on her website on April 10th. And I'm wondering, Madonna is a tremendous trend sniffer. So if she's going anti-war and criticizing the American way of life, what does this mean for politics in the near future? But let's leave that to the pop culture critics to figure out. We're now joined in the studio by some of the contributors to Implicating Empire, Globalization and Resistance in the 21st Century World Order, recently published by Basic Books. We have one of the co-editors, Heather Gautney, in the studio, and two of the contributors, Ellen Willis, Pete Bratzis, and on the phone we've got Michael Hart, who is joining us from Durham, North Carolina. Welcome to all of you.
Hi.
Hello, Michael. Thanks for joining us. First, Heather, just give us as one of the co-editors of the book, give us the overview. What's in it?
Well, there's actually three sections in the book. I probably should give you a little history. There was a conference at the CUNY Graduate Center put on by myself and Stanley Aronowitz, and also members of a group called Left Turn here in New York City. And the conference was called Globalization and Resistance. It was in November 2001. And we actually had been organizing the conference before September 11th. So, of course, September 11th came around and completely reoriented the focus of the conference. But as far as the book being a product of that conference, there are three sections. One of them is devoted to terrorism and war because of the September 11th event. The second is on the state and imperialism and the political economy, and most specifically focused on the empire thesis put forth by Hart and Negri. And then the third section is on the culture of globalization, which is very broad. There's pieces in there about anarchism and the new left, about the resistance movements in Argentina. Jeremy Brecker did a piece, Globalization from Below, putting forth his ideas. And also there's sections on, there's pieces on the environment and spaces of capital.
And I'm just looking at the cover. I see Michael Ratner, of course, has a piece about civil liberty crackdown in the United States, Manning Marable about racism and imperial war. How many contributors in all?
21 total.
So it's a pretty broad array of contributors and lots of perspectives. And now, now that the book is out, you've got, I guess, fate is playing with you again, because now sort of eclipsing the 9/11 story is the Iraq War. And your particular contribution to the book is about mostly about the Israel-Palestine conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Would you? How much would you change now? Is anything been rendered obsolete by events?
I think, in terms of my own piece, not at all. In fact, I think that the Iraq situation is very much an extension of the things that I discuss. Really, the focus of the piece is on the question of violence and world violence. It's entitled "The Globalization of Violence." So, you know, you can draw conclusions from that. One of the specific things that I think is particularly relevant to this situation, which is an idea that I stole from Hart and Negri, or I cite them, is the question of how. What legitimizes power in the current world order, and the use of an ethical kind of humanitarian component, and the ability of force such as that from the United States to apply force effectively. And I think in Iraq we're really seeing that the war is being entirely legitimized on these grounds. And, you know, with the humanitarian question, I'm sort of reacting to what you said earlier in terms of it being a unilateral war, because I think that that element of it calls that into question with other countries that are lined up sort of as the second line in a way of the United States war plan to come and do cleanup. I think that that implicates other nations, and that there might be sort of an underpinning of this that might be broader than just simply the United States as an imperial power. So that's, yeah.
Well, since you mentioned Michael Hart and we have him on the phone, Michael, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
First of all, I wanted you to react to what Heather said, but also in your when I had you on the show, I guess it was last summer maybe, we were talking about whether Bush would get his war, and you're talking about the importance of that the world of United States running things was at least looked like it might it might be very constraints on unilateral American action. Have the events of the Iraq War caused you to rethink any of that?
Well, sure. Doug, there's both things. I mean, one thing is all of us are very stubborn. We always try to see everything as, like, confirming just what we always thought. On the other hand, yeah, you have to change ideas with these things. I think, we have gone further in a project of U.S. unilateralism and, in a way, separating a project to, as I see it, or maybe this seems quite obvious, to separate the U.S. unilateral actions from what was previously a kind of collaboration with a whole network of subordinated but nonetheless important powers, such as the European nation states, the UN, other international organizations, etc. And so what this operation has been is not just, of course, a war on Iraq, and not just an attempt to remake the political map of the Middle East, but to reorganize the structures of global power. And I think we have gone, seen a much further step in the a separation of U.S. unilateral power from this other network.
Well, a lot of people criticized you and Tony Negri, the book Empire and subsequent works, for having really underplayed the importance of U.S. power and U.S. imperialism. And in when you lay out this this new concept of empire, which is a much supposedly beyond or above the nation state, a lot of people said, it's still really the same old American imperialism. Now that the bombs are flying, there seems to be some physical confirmation of the critique. Do you feel like maybe they had a point?
Well, I don't. I mean, I do think that it's an important argument. I've never thought that it's not worth it's not a reasonable argument. I still think that it's not useful to read this in terms of the old notions of imperialism. I think that it is, in fact, something different. The fact that the U.S. is acting unilaterally now, or attempting to create a more unilateral, let's say, decision-making process, doesn't seem to me that one has to revert back to the older structures of imperialism to understand it.
What would you propose instead?
Well, I think that this, that in a way recognizing, well, what I was just suggesting is this, there, in a way, when we're talking about empire, or, and we're certainly not alone in trying to read the emergence of a post-Cold War global order as a kind of collaboration between, say, monarchical level occupied by the United States and a broad, let's call it aristocratic network of powers of various nation states and capitalist corporations and supranational organizations, that there has to be a kind of collaboration between these two forces. So in a way, and this is the way, I mean, Tony and I have always been in a way contradictory about whether the U.S. is the center of this thing or not, because it is in a way contradictory, or that's the way we see it, that the that this unilateralist superpower has to collaborate with. So it's both a single power and part of a larger network. I think that the present Bush Jr. Administration is trying to, in a way, heighten the singular element of this. But that doesn't deny that there has to be an important, let's say, collaboration with other powers. One shouldn't imagine that the U.S., when at its most extreme examples of going it alone, that it doesn't need the consent and collaboration of a variety of other powers. One has to recognize how these things are important, and I'm sure that they recognize how they're important.
And of course, we've got Bulgaria on our side now, right?
Well, how could you lose?
Pete Bretsis, when we were talking earlier, you said you wanted to say some things about American nationalism, so this seems like an appropriate point to insert some thoughts on that. It certainly looks like the Bush gang is some of the most intense gang of Bible and flag wavers that we've ever seen in power in this country. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, this is obviously true that it's one component, a significant component of the contemporary American project, religious fervor, and this idea that one makes a sacrifice. I mean, the French, for example, are too self-interested to risk their lives going to Iraq to liberate the Iraqis. Always the Americans have to make the sacrifice. They are always generous and willing to spread good and democracy around the world. But also in terms of this question of empire and imperialism, I think one of the main manifestations, and a very concrete manifestation of the state, is this its ability to create this cohesive national community. And I think today, both on the part of those who support the war and those who are against, you see, nonetheless, a very strong identification with the American national community. I mean, to say we don't, that, for example, that we don't support the troops, even among those who oppose the war, is almost unthinkable. Always one has to go through the rituals that we're against the war, but nonetheless, yes, we're part of it. Yes, we see ourselves as Americans. Our boys are there. We support the troops. And, of course, it should be possible to say, you know, we don't support the troops. We don't identify with the American national image. We don't want to be part of or see ourselves as part of that group.
Well, some of the slogans you see and hear at anti-war rallies include peace is patriotic.
Yes.
And support the troops, bring them home.
Right.
How do you feel about that? Is that conceding too much to the patriotic narrative does it make you uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, one can see it as competing projects or visions of what is to be an American. But at the same time, I mean, the idea that we have on the one side nationalism, which is a bad thing. I mean, it's, you know, Yugoslavs and Iraqis most likely, and you know, other lesser peoples, but in the West we have a patriotism, which is of course virtuous and good, is I think not a very good and rigorous distinction. I mean, still the phenomena they're describing are the same, this identification with the the nation, whether it's defined upon ethnic lines or not. Nonetheless, I mean, there's strong and a very strong emotional tie to it. So whether it's an American going out there willing to die for George Bush and the flag and Texas or whatever it is that they're from, or of course it's some Yugoslav dying for some vision of past glory or some Iraqi dying, you know, it's still, whether you call it patriotism or nationalism, seems to me it's the same thing.
Let's see, where can we go from here? Ellen Willis, you are your contribution to the book is about psychosexual aspects of terrorism, and I remember at the conference when you started talking about that, and you mentioned this in your piece, that people kind of laughed at you, that it was kind of wrong to bring matters of the psyche and sex into the world of political economy. First of all, could you just give us a sketch of how you think it plays out, and why the reaction?
I mean, I do think people feel very uncomfortable with that, and if in fact my ideas about it are right, it like makes sense that people would feel uncomfortable. Basically, what I'm arguing is that there's a whole dimension of politics that has to do with unconscious psychological conflict, which in turn has to do with our deep cultural formation that goes on kind of beneath the substratum of our rational, political, economic argument. And I don't think these things are separate. I think they're totally intertwined. I don't think you can understand Bush and the war in Iraq and his whole administration and his neoconservative supporters without understanding both the geopolitical and psychological and cultural aspects of it. I think in many ways American unilateralism, the dream of empire that's being floated now, is not the same thing as the old imperialism. It's really a kind of a backlash movement to the fact that, in fact, we have now a much more complicated kind of system where the people, I believe, who are sort of fundamentally in control of what's really going on politically and economically are transnational corporations that don't really know national boundaries. This isn't to say that the state has therefore become unimportant, but it seems to me particularly the neoconservatives in this country are reacting very strongly to, in some sense, a loss of primacy of the state and of nationalism, you know, in the sense that they want to promote it. And I think this intersects very well with Bush's fundamentalism and his Manichaean view of the world, which I think is very much a part of his policy. And I think those things have to be taken into consideration, you know, without neglecting, you know, all the other economic and political things that are going on.
I should say this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and also on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the show is Behind the News. And speaking with some of the contributors to the collection Implicating Empire, Globalization, and Resistance in the 21st Century World Disorder, edited by Stanley Aronowitz and Heather Gautney. And you're just hearing from one of the contributors, Ellen Willis, also in the studio, one of the editors, Heather Gautney, and one of the contributors, Pete Bratzis, and on the phone is Michael Hart. Joining us from Durham, North Carolina. Now, your piece, Ellen, originally was about the piece in the collection was about the fundamentalists who drove the planes into the World Trade Center and the psychosexual aspects of that. Yeah. Now our enemy is one of the few avowedly secular regimes in that portion of the world. And it would seem to me that the most compelling and interesting set of fundamentalists are the ones in Washington now. How do you apply your analysis to Iraq as enemy?
Well, I think I just did say a little bit about how I think my ideas apply to Bush. I do think that the Iraqi Ba'athist movement it has certain kinds of things that remind one of Stalinism and a certain kind of things that remind one of fascism. It's a formation that's secular, but that's ultra-nationalist and extremely authoritarian. In fact, I think you'd have to say that Iraq is a totalitarian state and a terroristic state. It doesn't necessarily have to do with religion. I think Pol Pot, so far as I know, was not religious. I think religious fundamentalism is sort of only one form. Many of these authoritarian and totalitarian impulses can take. But I think that both the secular versions and the religious versions of authoritarianism fundamentally come out of a patriarchal authoritarian culture that's about 5,000 years old. And to put it in perspective, it's sort of only for the last couple of hundred years that ideas about democracy and genuine opposition to that cultural formation have even been, have been on the agenda at all.
Well, a lot of the ideas about diversity and democracy and secularism are the products of, you could say, they're almost luxury goods. They're things that people in the rich parts of the world have enjoyed, but that their wealth has depended upon the creation of very, very poor and marginalized colonies or neo-colonies of various sorts. It's not that progress is something that happens in time moving forwards, but something that's spread out across space. We have this this little realm of freedom here, but it depends upon the creation of hierarchical and oppressive regimes elsewhere. How do you feel about that?
There are also democratic movements and impulses and secular movements and impulses and feminism and sort of all these things really all over the world, not just in the so-called advanced, enlightened countries. I think that view of the world is really too mechanical that you just expressed.
Well, then, you've also been criticized for using your critique of fundamentalism as a way of legitimizing imperial interventions, that it's the enlightened people going after the barbarians. And, first of all, who are we to proclaim ourselves enlightened, but, who are we to proclaim them barbarians? Does your argument in some way encourage the Bushes of the world to promote their civilizing agenda?
Well, I don't think so, because I think that we're capable of making some distinctions here. I'm not basically a cultural relativist. I feel like, when you have a government that stones women to death for adultery, just to take one example, this is something that can be recognized universally as not a good thing. I don't believe that women in such countries really want to be terrorized and, feel like it's their traditions which are being upheld. They've certainly not had a voice in defining that. And I think that the complication is that, we are a member of a nation state whose motives in intervening in the world are not always the motives that we would choose. And yet there are times when I still feel it's necessary to intervene. My reasons may be different from Bush's reasons, and I think that that's a moral ambiguity, but I feel that it's an unavoidable one. I mean, I did think that we should, I was for intervention in Bosnia and Kosovo. I think we should have intervened in Bosnia a lot earlier. I do believe that we needed, as a matter of self-defense, to intervene in Afghanistan, and yet, and I think it's sort of very important to sort of differentiate what I think and why I feel that we should intervene from other and criticize sort of other possible motives and other possible consequences of intervention. But sometimes there sort of is no, in a world of nation states, I feel like there is no moral purity, that it's like not about moral purity. It's like a, sort of about figuring out what you really have to do in a particular situation.
Any reaction from anyone else to that? No? No one wants to talk about that? Well, it seems like, to some degree, the rhetoric around intervening in Kosovo, the human rights rhetoric, the idea that certain transcendent rights exceed those the considerations of sovereignty, have been now applied by George Bush to Iraq to just something that looks like a pure, naked, imperial adventure. You're shaking your head, Pete Bratzis. What?
Yes.
Okay. Michael, did you want to say something?
Well, briefly, because I thought I could tie that and Ellen's comments back to something that Heather said at the beginning. It seems to me that you post in a general terms that that we've seen a change in the at least arguments for the legitimation of state violence, of U.S. state violence. You could think of it in the general terms like this, that the first Gulf War, the basis for legitimation was international law. I'm not saying that that was the only motivation, but that was certainly the legitimating argument about restoring the sovereignty of a nation state. In that sense, it's very much based in international law. In Kosovo, really, we had not a legal basis for the legitimation of U.S. or coalition violence, but rather a moral argument, which seemed to me what Heather was talking about before, and in a certain sense, I think what Ellen was talking about. In other words, the discourse of human rights, rather than a legal argument, because, of course, we were violating state sovereignty, but on a moral basis, that would be the justification or the legitimation of the violence. It seems to me that in this Gulf War, or in this war against Iraq, there is neither a legal nor a moral justification. The justification, it seems to me, rather lies on a different basis, really on the effects of the violence. In other words, it seems to me that this U.S. military action is counting on and is arguing for a legitimation based on its ability to bring order to the world, which it seems to me, for one thing, it's interesting to note how far we've moved from traditional structures of legitimation of state violence. But another thing, it seems clear to me in this, but someone might disagree with how I'm seeing it, that this is in a way the most tenuous and unstable form of legitimation of violence, because it will only be legitimated afterwards in retrospect based on its effects. Insofar as it can have reordering effects, it may be legitimated. But in the event that it doesn't restore the previous order of those in power, it will not be legitimated. So it's very different than the kind of a priori, beforehand legitimation of either the legal foundation or the moral foundation. I think that we're seeing something new here, and it's worth analyzing.
Well, the Bush administration also thought it was going to be welcomed with flowers and cheers, and instead it's being welcomed by guerrilla war.
Right.
I think they're looking to the flowers and cheers to legitimate their action as well.
Exactly, but again, I think that's part of the retroactive legitimation, which is a very different kind of legitimation than, say, acting on a legal basis. It just like you're saying, it was counting on certain effects, and they only legitimate the action looking backwards, or don't.
And anyone here want to react to that?
I mean, the legal question is a significant question in terms of the legitimation of the actions, but the fact that having a UN resolution or Security Council resolution, as in the first Gulf War, or NATO as a collective being the main actor in Kosovo, is not in and of itself sufficiently legitimizing without certain presuppositions. So, I mean, then for people to take that decision and say, yes, this is a good idea, some process was followed, this, you know, we're going to follow it, I think also ties in to the previous sort of classic imperialist and colonialist tendency of going in there and sort of civilizing the savages, as in many ways you said before.
Yeah, some of this rhetoric is 100, 200 years old.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that part is very old. I mean, whatever the mechanisms may be that through which then we justify it, whether it's by way of Christianity and going there to Christianize heathens, or it's, you know, Balkan passions that are 500 years old, and we have to go in there and separate them because they're incapable of living together properly, or if it's, you know, anomalous Muslims in Iraq who may be, you know, gentle and nice in many ways, but there's this evil leader who is leading them down the path to ruin and subjugation. Nonetheless, still that element is there, and we still have that hierarchy. And I agree with Ellen in many ways that we can agree that, yes, to stone women is not a good thing. But it's a difference between doing that on the basis of political, as a political project, that we sit together. And it's not about going looking for some universal. I mean, there are many books now on what, you know, where the discussion is, what is a just war? When is it just to go to war? So it looks for some kind of transcendental, whether it's divine or not, you know, way of justifying the violence. And I think this is an apolitical tendency that one can say, look, politics is about establishing what we think is good and bad, what way we think is a good way to live, and let's keep it on that level. Not on the level of, if we follow certain procedures, then it becomes just, or if we can deduce through some manipulation of ethics what then is a just war, then this is sufficient. But it's an open question, political question, no gods involved, and no transcendental truths.
So if the Security Council had approved action against Iraq, would you still...
Then you could still say it's bad. It doesn't matter that they follow a certain procedure. On the level of politics, on the level of how they perceive what is the good, I disagree. We have competing political visions, and then it's real politics as possible.
Bad on what grounds, then?
Bad simply in terms of what I or other people would think as being the proper way of living. The good, you know, what is the good in a very general sense. I mean, particular reasons could be anything. I mean, you know, the reasons I may be opposed to invading and bombing Iraq may be different from someone else. But I'm saying those kinds of questions, that kind of dialogue, is politics. It's not politics when we say it's a just war when X is met, or when this procedure is followed, and thus, okay, then everything is cool. You know, don't say anything, be quiet, or anything else.
That was the voice of Pete Bratzis, who is one of the contributors to Implicating Empire, Globalization, and Resistance in the 21st Century World Order, edited by Stanley Aronowitz and Heather Gottney, and published by Basic Books. I think most of us agree that stoning women for adultery is a very, very bad thing. Does that mean that we should send in the Marines to stop it?
You're asking me?
Yeah, well, anyone wants to. We'll start with you.
I don't think it necessarily means that. I mean, any time that you're talking about sending in the Marines... By the way, there was one thing I wanted to comment on before, which is that the support for the troops thing, I think, is not purely a nationalist thing. There's a large element of people feeling regretful that during Vietnam, a lot of the left scapegoated the troops who were not the people who were, you know, the ones who were prosecuted.
Which, as I understand, is not really historically true. There was not an awful lot of hostility towards ordinary GIs.
Well, there was. There was some. I was there, and I remember that, in fact, there was a lot of it. And then there was a debate about it, and there were, you know, a lot of people who, you know, really criticized that. But I think sort of in any given situation, you have to ask, generally speaking, it's sort of a good idea to kind of have some kind of rebellion in the country first that you might want to intervene to help, rather than sort of simply deciding that you don't like the social arrangements of the country and you're going to send the Marines in and change it, basically because you don't really have much likelihood of changing it, I don't think, under those circumstances. You know, at least that's the way things have pretty much worked in the past. I think when you have an emergency situation, genocide is going on, then I think you have to go in and intervene without sort of necessarily waiting for some indigenous force to invite you in. Although, you know, of course, in Bosnia, for example, there were such indigenous forces, and we didn't go in and help them. But I think...
Now, who are this we that are going to go in to help
right.
them? Michael,
the
do you want
we,
to...
The U.S.
military, I think.
Nation state of which I am a part, whether I like it or not. But the U.S. government, the U.S. military, I'm talking about in this particular instance...
Which, with very few exceptions, has been one of the most violent and repressive institutions the world has ever seen. So, I mean, why should they somehow be transformed into the good guys? How is this going to happen?
Well, I don't think that the United States has been one of the most violent and repressive nations the world has ever seen. I think that's...
Well, I said the U.S. military. I mean, we killed 3 million people in
hyperbolic.
Indochina.
Well, militaries, by definition, are violent. That's their job. That's what they do. But... Military do not, you know, at least in the United States, generally make policy. It's the civilians who are responsible for what the military do. And, you know, it's the civilian government that has to make the decision about whether to send in the Marines or not and should be held responsible for whether they do so or not and under what circumstances.
Well, yeah, killing 3 million people in Indochina, you know, another 1.5 million in Iraq as a result of sanctions, this seems like a fairly fanciful vision of what the U.S. government is likely to do, or even can be trusted to do. I mean, even you know, people who found the war in Iraq justified to some degree. I mean, the behavior of the U.S. During the war and since has been abominable. I mean, why even entertain this as a question? It just gives fuel to the likes of George Bush to wrap his intentions in humanitarian garb.
But again, that would likely happen anyway. I mean, you know, regardless of what anyone in New York City says or in WBAI or City University of New York. I mean, Bush will follow his. I mean, that, of course, is one of the problems, how increasingly authoritarian the whole process becomes.
I think we have to make our own judgments on things, regardless of what Bush might then use them to say. You know, we cannot abdicate this function of making judgments. You know, and I don't think it's enough to just sort of emotionally talk about millions of people who have been killed. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the history of the world, it's an extremely bloody and violent, oppressive and repressive history, and doesn't make you too optimistic about the future of the human race in general. But I don't feel, finally, that this helps much when you're trying to figure out in a particular situation what to do or what to support your particular nation state in imperfect and fucked up in many ways nation state for doing.
I'm supposed to say those words on the air.
Sorry.
I have a hard time imagining the 101st Airborne as an instrument of liberation. I guess I'm just unimaginative, though. Heather Gautney, your contribution is in part about the generalization of violence in the world. And you know, how do you feel about this talk of the 101st Airborne as an instrument of liberation?
Well, I think I actually I agree very much with what Peter's saying, that I think, of course, we have to sort out our political programs and formulate opinions, but I think that through collective action is how things get changed, and if we can somehow try to sort of disband the way that power is being legitimized, this point that I made earlier, then I think that's what should be of concern right now. I mean, kind of going back and forth about our opinions regarding the level of violence or what we should do in terms of intervention, to me, doesn't really seem to do anything outside of the level of discourse. So I think that part of the thing that I was trying to do in the piece is to say, well, we need to get outside of a logic of violence and need to get outside of a logic of ethics and morality and try to try to involve ourselves again politically. And I think the only way that can happen right now is through very, very mass collective action.
Well, yeah, let's talk about resistance, which is in the last 5 minutes. But here we are. We saw some very interesting actions today, civil disobedience actions around the city. We've seen massive, massive anti-war demonstrations in this country and elsewhere around the world. Any sense of why this is happening in the first place? I mean, why this, in many ways, this looks like a fairly routine imperial war that didn't, of a sort, that didn't provoke this level of opposition this quickly in the past. Any sense of why it's happening this time?
Well, I think that there was a current already underway with the globalization movement that was quite powerful. So I think that the anti-war movement already sort of had this really, really strong base from which to build. Although I think that there are sort of some parallels that are not meeting in these two kind of, if you want to call them, separate movements. But I think that there's a lot of work to be done in marrying them. But something about this war, I think, really is resonating with people in terms of just how powerless we are as individuals. I think that the actions of the Bush administration just seem so intensely rogue, and public opinion is so clearly, you look at the polls, even the public polls is, CNN is saying that there's, I don't know the exact number, but 40% dissent against the war is very, very significant in this country. So I think that it's sort of bringing people out that would normally stay inside just to sort of kind of feel powerful again, or at least feel somewhat involved in making decisions regarding their own fate. And I think that the fiscal crisis is also helping to radicalize people.
I think there's a war at home going on, as well as a war overseas.
What do you mean?
You have an administration that basically came into office illegally, did not win the popular vote, proceeded to institute an ultra-conservative program on which Bush did not campaign as if he had all the mandate in the world. It's been extremely bold, and, of course, the Democrats have offered no opposition whatsoever. They've completely caved. And I think a lot of people are extremely frustrated and angry about that.
And Michael Hart, is the kind of movement we've been talking about an instance of what you and Tony Negri call the multitude in action?
Yeah, I think in many ways it is. The defining moment for me recently was February 15th, and maybe February 15th even as following up on Porto Alegre. But in fact, the greatest miracle of my recent life is that the New York Times actually had good things to say about the demonstration after February 15th. I think I've never seen that before. And the on Monday afterwards, they started a front page article saying, there are now two superpowers in the world, the United States and global public opinion. I mean, first of all, it's a remarkable thing to say. Secondly, that the New York Times would say it was really amazing. I think this is indicative of a lot of things. What Ellen was mentioning, which is, I think, a great conflict, let's say, within the power structure in the U.S. But the other thing that it's also indicative of is this new ability to have an extremely expansive, if not yet, of course, global movement and consciousness of it. I think February 15th was really a remarkable, let's say, first experiment in that.
I just want to, I don't mean to burst your bubble, Michael, but the recent protest, I guess it was March 22nd, was in the B section on page 11.
No, I'm so not saying that the Times has changed its tune or something, but they did write that on the after the 15th. No, I'm not becoming an advocate of the Times or anything.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we have to bring it to a close there. Thanks to all of you for joining us. That's Michael Hart, Duke University, by phone from North Carolina, Heather Gautney, and Ellen Willis and Pete Bratz is in the studio, all contributors to the book Implicating Empire, Globalization, and Resistance in the 21st Century World Order, published by Basic Books. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. We'll be back next week, and let's go out with this stirring anthem from Elvis Costello.
Searching for light in the darkness of insanity.